A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The world continues to turn, and we still need to eat, so here we go.
First of all, what's schmaltz, and then what's gribbenus?
So schmaltz is rendered chicken fat. You know, you have any number of animal fats. In Jewish cooking, it's, you know, pretty much everything is done with the rendered chicken fat.
That's Laura Avery talking to Jeremy Fox at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. He's the executive chef at Rustic Canyon.
So when you render chicken fat, you can add a lot of onions, and then the solids that have been kind of caramelized up, the chicken fat and the onions have caramelized and sweetened and are super flavorful. That is good just spread on toast or thrown in with eggs. It's pretty much good on everything. And we kind of process it in kind of a smooth mixture with our, whatever kind of kimchi we made at the time. And it works really well.
And Jeremy, you come to the market all the time. What are you shopping for today?
I saw the black radish, like nice kind of slightly larger than baby size black radish from Weiser.
They are jet black on the outside. What are they like on the inside?
Inside is white. It depends on the actual radish, how kind of smooth or kind of crunchy it is. Sometimes they're a little bit more fibrous than others. But these look like they're all really firm, so I think they're going to be nice and kind of crunchy and very spicy. All radishes are pretty spicy, but the black radish are almost have kind of a wasabi hit to them at first, and then it kind of mellows out. But we make a pan de mie, so we do is we griddle that in schmaltz and then spread it with gribbenus, a Jewish preparation of chicken fat and onions, and that gets seasoned with homemade kimchi, and that gets spread on, and then we're going to shave some of that black radish right on top for crunch and spice.
Are there radishes and other things like that in the kimchi too?
Sometimes we make, we made a daikon radish kimchi. Sometimes we make it out of basil leaves, sometimes sorrel leaves.
Can you use the radish tops in that?
Yes, definitely. We've used the radish tops before. And the black radish at Weiser right now have the greens on them, so it's definitely worth it to get them.
Yeah. So the theme, the sort of the Jewish style or the Jewish traditional ingredients, is that something you're specializing in now at Rustic Canyon?
No, it's I'm Jewish, and it's, how I grew up with my grandmother cooking in the kitchen all day. So there's aspects of that, as a chef, you kind of pull inspiration from a lot of things as you've been exposed to. So that's definitely an element.
And kimchi seems to be just what everybody is doing right now.
I love kimchi. I just fed my 10-month-old kimchi the other day and she loved it.
So you do that sort of on an ongoing basis. You'll do stuff in the back, in the restaurant. You'll do pickling and kimchi and all that kind of stuff.
I love slow food. We do a lot of pickling and curing and fermenting. Anytime we have duck prosciutto, we have olives brining, sauerkraut, different kojis and miso. We're always working on that kind of stuff. It's really interesting to us.
And how much schmaltz are you going through a week?
We go through about 80 to 100 pounds of chicken fat a week. Our beef is cooked in rendered beef fat. Our pork is cooked in rendered pork fat. Our chicken is cooked in rendered chicken fat. So we go through a lot of animal fats.
And that can all go on toast too, I suppose.
It can all go on toast, yeah.
All right, Jeremy, this sounds fabulous. Perfect fall, kind of warm, cozy, super fatty to keep you going all winter. It just sounds delicious. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm visiting now with Alex Weiser, who is the farm that Jeremy gets those black radishes from. Alex is a well-known farmer at so many markets in Southern California. Can we just talk about your radishes?
Yes, please do. They're very radishing.
Okay. So Jeremy was describing the black radish as being the spiciest.
Yeah, that's our spiciest winter radish we carry. It has a lot of heat, which everybody likes sweet and but people are looking for a strong, real radish that has a lot of bite to it, and that's it. And this is an heirloom radish that's been around since the 16th century. And we like to grow heirlooms, and they look awesome, too.
They are literally coal black.
Yeah, and they look like kind of like truffle or something, don't they?
They do.
Yes.
Yeah. They are in season now. They're really big. Are they just, you pick them little and then they get bigger, bigger, bigger?
I haven't noticed a difference in the sizes, but we plant them in the late summer because if we planted them in the spring, they would bolt and go to seed. So they're particularly a radish for the winter, and they like the frost. It's when they have better flavor, too. The frost gives them better flavor. We have the watermelon radish. It's beautiful, red inside.
Yeah, are they a popular item on your table?
They are, more and more every year. And another thing is, you know, they weren't always called watermelon radish. You know, it was Alex from Briar Patch way back in the day that dubbed the name watermelon radish. It's actually, it has a Chinese name. It's a Chinese red meat radish. But they look like watermelon, right? That's what us farmers do. Like, that's why I named it honeydew radish on the green meat radish to honor them. Because they look like a honeydew. So I think the name, too, changed the whole thing.
So we just had a slice of that black radish. That is really hot. Is that the hottest one you grow?
Well, we are growing horseradish this year that I'm very excited about. That we're growing, it's in the ground, but we want the frost. More frost, and the harsher the weather, the better the horseradish gets. So we're going to be marketing them and growing them differently than your average horseradish that you see at the supermarket. That's this giant, like, baseball bat.
So
we'll see. We'll see the results.
Okay, and they'll be just as hot?
I think so. I mean, we're growing them up in the mountains, and we get snow and frost. We have the right climate for it, so I've been asked to grow it year after year, so we're finally doing it.
Well, this is exciting. So
yeah, it is.
February, March, we'll see the horseradish?
Yes. And then in the years to come, we'll have bigger crops, because I know it's going to be a winner.
People can get their horseradish recipes ready now.
Yeah, get ready. Here it comes.
All right, Alex. Thanks so much. It's always so much fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Likewise.
That was Alex Weiser. He is a man who loves being a farmer. You can tell. And he's going to be the first farmer, I think, ever at the market to grow horseradish. This is very exciting. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Next up, we talk to a musician who's lately been turning her beats to food. Stay with us.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. You better believe that her milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. Yep, that familiar hook is from the hit single Milkshake by the guest I have in studio with me now, Kalise Rogers, who most of us know simply as Kalise. She's released 6 albums and has been nominated for 2 Grammys. And in the past decade, the 37-year-old has redirected her mixes and beats to food.
It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So your dad was a jazz musician and your mother was a caterer. What do you remember about watching your mom cook when you were growing up in Harlem?
Well, first of all, she's this tiny person. She's like 4'11", which she, you know, she like lies and says she's 5'1", which is hilarious. But she's just this tiny, tiny person and she's got this massive personality. And I just remember how sort of stealth she was and how like quick and just it seemed effortless and I'm not that way.
Were you folded into it from sort of the time that you were conscious? Like, did you help? Were you allowed to peel things?
I loved watching my mom. And I think because I have sisters and they enjoy cooking, I think. I don't think that they are cooks, per se. I think out of all of my sisters, though, like, I was the other one. And so my mom would always be like, well, you're not doing anything. Go wash your hands. And then that was when I was really little. And then I started to really love it. And yeah, I think she started to see something in me and sort of, like, I became her helper.
So during this period that you were building your brand musically and traveling all over the world, what was the relationship you had with food during that period of time?
I'm not a big planner. I guess I've gotten more of a planner as I've gotten older, but in starting out, I was never a huge planner. And so everything kind of just like, you know, just sort of happened. Music kind of just happened and, you know, I went with it. Because I was traveling so much, though, food was always, I'm not going to say in the back of my mind, but it was just something that was also always there. Like I'm always, if I have an extra day, I'm like, oh, let's go on a food tour. Or let's, I heard that this had the best, like, street food. Like, always just tasting things. And I like to eat. And, like, I might never be here again. Let's go try something we might never find back home. And so that kind of thing. So it's always been a big part, but not really, like, purposefully. Just sort of, like, because that's who I am.
Like it used to be.
Before there was Instagram.
You're right. You're totally... Yes, we were just living our lives.
Exactly.
With no proof that it was happening. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You also got exposed to food from all over the world just in New York.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like people say it's a melting pot, but it thoroughly is. I grew up in Harlem, so just in our area alone, there was some of the best Caribbean food and just, you know, Jamaican food. And then there's like Spanish Harlem is blocks away. And so there was within like a, you know, 5 mile radius. There was so much. But then just being on the island of Manhattan, I mean, you know, the Lower East Side, like in Alphabet City, like we used to go down and go for Polish food on Sundays. And then there was like Little Italy and Chinatown. And some of the best food in the world, I think, still comes out of that little tiny island.
You got to a place where your music career was at a space where you were looking at it perhaps more critically than you had in the past. You were living in my hometown of Silver Lake. And you made a decision about going to cooking school. Can you take us back to that moment?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think just economically in our country, like, during that time, so many things were shifting and changing, and the internet started to boom. It was financially just this, you know, the crash and everything. Everything changed. And so we didn't know how it was going to change, but it all changed. And so, you know, the label that I was signed to, all of the CEOs and heads of that label that had specifically and personally signed me were then no longer there. So then they're taking all these artists and we're being traded. Like, we're there with no kind of, like, you're just all of a sudden now you're signed up to this...
A different team.
That would have never happened under any other circumstances. I ended up being signed to Jive, which was like, it was NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, I think, and Britney Spears, and couldn't be further away from where it was that I was and who I was and what I was trying to do. And so, you know, it was like a bad relationship. So basically, I was there, and I'd fought for so many years to get off. It was like 4 years went by and 2 albums, that by the time I finally got the call from my lawyer to say, hey, you've been released, I was just like, oh... Well, great. What do I do now? I have no plans for what happens when I finally get off. And so, I was sitting in my kitchen one day, and I was living in Silver Lake, and I used to have like a little television screen in my kitchen. Just, you know, I've watched cooking shows or whatever. And this commercial came on for culinary school, and I was like, oh, I could do that now. Like, why not now? So I did.
It's so rare we make time for those kind of opportunities and dreams. So in 2014, you released an album with a live band and horn section that was called Food, which I love. Many of the songs are named after all kinds of delicious things that we eat. Jerk ribs, biscuits and gravy, cobbler, Friday fish fry, and hooch. The opening track, Breakfast, is introduced by your son, Knight. So let's go ahead and listen.
Hey, guys. Are you hungry? My mom made food.
Ooh. Ah.
So why did you make that album?
Well, I wanted to do something that brought me back to, I guess, how it all started for me and just being, you know, a jazz baby. It was all I heard. Like, my dad used to play the saxophone. He played all the reeds, but like my parents bought a brownstone in the early 80s in Harlem. And so my dad like renovated each room. So there was a point when, like, the whole downstairs area was renovated and my dad was, like, banished to the upstairs area to, you know, obviously renovate. But also that became his, like, rehearsal space. And so, I mean, especially on the weekends, like, from morning until night, like, we would wake up in the morning to the sound of the saxophone. And by the time we went to sleep, it was still going. And he was just playing. So just, you know, you started to just sort of drown it out. But it was the soundtrack for my life. And I think for me, making the record Food, it was really... I wanted it to be live. I wanted to be, you know, in every aspect of it. And that's how it started. I named it Food later on because while I was recording this record with these really phenomenal musicians, we were all in my friend and producer's house, you know, Dave Sadek, and there was a kitchen. So it would be like, we're going to lay this vocal down or lay this trumpet sound down. And I'm like, we're hungry. We have to eat, you know? And so we just started cooking, and the names of the songs were just working titles for whatever we were either eating that day or thinking about eating that day. And then, yeah, you know, by the time it was over, I was just like, good as any other name, might as well leave it.
Last year, you published a book, My Life on a Plate. It's a cookbook of recipes from around the world. And in the intro to the book, you write, "The food I'm drawn to is the food that tells us who we are and what we are." What is that food for you?
I didn't realize it until I really started writing the book that, like, I'm so much more Puerto Rican than I think I am. I think just because of the food. Like, if you don't hear me talk and you just eat my food, I am thoroughly Puerto Rican. It's because that's what I grew up, that my mom made it the best, you know, and my grandmother and the summers we spent, you know, in Puerto Rico. And I'm very American. So that's, I think that's something that I think in those terms. But then it's all these other things that were always kind of plated on top of it that make up who I am. You know, it's the Puerto Rican and the Chinese and the Black and just all these things that sort of, they all become, for me, they're all one thing. And so that's what my food usually looks like.
You have a sauce line now called Bounty and Full. You'll also be cooking from a food truck this month. What's on your menu?
Well, it's brunch. So, you know, I tried to keep it as breakfasty, brunchy as possible. But it's, I've always been thinking about kind of a take on a egg sandwich, like egg McMuffin. So I did a soft shell crab biscuit with a poached egg, and it's got a rosemary aioli. And another classical thing that I, you know, twisted around is I do a Belgian waffle, but like a real Belgian waffle, not like a battery Belgian waffle. But it's a red quinoa waffle, and it's served with a filet mignon and a bone marrow bordelaise gravy. It's a very savory dish. It's nice. And I do like a matcha green tea pancake, but it's in a like little cast iron skillet and things like that. Just sort of, they're all traditional breakfast things, but just done in, you know, my kind of flavor senses, I think. My umami.
How fun. And do you have a specific playlist while you're cooking?
It depends. You know, like sometimes, like if I'm home and I'm just experimenting, sometimes it's just quiet. And then other times I'll play Rye or who I love, or like Sam Dew, or I don't know, it could be anything from like Sheryl Crow to Sam Cooke, honestly. So it just depends.
Sounds wonderful. So are there any spots that you're traveling soon where you're looking forward to eating a particular kind of food?
Oh gosh, it's November, right? I spent a lot of like the past 2 months in Asia. I was in Singapore and I was in Vietnam and where was I? Hong Kong. So that's really inspired just kind of what I've been thinking lately and just, you know, in the past few months. I have no idea where I'm going coming up, honestly. I just sort of show up, find the street food.
That's the best, though.
Yeah.
Kalees is a musician and a chef. Find her pernil recipe, the Puerto Rican pork shoulder dish passed down to her by her grandmother on the Good Food blog. I really love pernil.
Our idea is if God did fast food, it's the salad ones, really, the salad dishes that really lend themselves to that sort of beautiful idea of being able to eat without guilt, but with huge amounts of flavor.
John Vincent is one of the founders of Leon in England, which is a chain of healthy fast food restaurants. His vision is to make fast food good food. His brand also features a line of cookbooks that are so happy looking. So it's not surprising that the latest is called Happy Salads. Can I start by asking about your experience with fast food growing up?
Oh, I mean, I loved fast food when I was growing up. I remember, I don't know whether I'm allowed to name names, but there's a brand with giant golden arches. And I used to go there at the end of term for my sort of end of term treat when I was a kid. And secondly, I remember when I was about 11, and maybe slightly younger, my mum booked me a birthday party at the place and home of the Golden Arches. And I remember I was on the floor kicking my arms and legs in the air. So I must admit it was a treat for me and I absolutely loved it.
Going from that beginning to purveying healthy food throughout the London area and beyond is quite a shift.
I mean, I think a lot of people grow a little bit older and they realize that perhaps the addiction that they have for fast food and for similar foods is not fantastic for them. And I did that sort of classic thing, sort of late 20s, realizing that this food was sort of A, making me fall asleep and B, making me sort of wake up fat. And I was getting less and less energy. I was working hard, like many people do. I was working in a consulting firm and, you know, we were eating cold sandwiches, fast food, and we were not, myself and Henry, my co-founder, we weren't getting any healthier. And we started looking into nutrition and we started thinking, look, you know, we love fast food. We love the fun, some of the sweet and sour flavors of fast food. But we knew we had to reinvent fast food if it was going to stop hurting people, especially ourselves. And we thought that was a big problem and a big opportunity. And if we could make it easier for everyone to eat and live well, then perhaps that would be a lifestyle and I guess a vocation that we would love to pursue.
As you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, salads have all these really intense high notes. They're crunchy. Sometimes there's the additional crunch of nuts or a crouton. You have the sourness or tanginess of a dressing. And then there's all that color. So in a way, it's perfect for fast food because it seduces people.
Well, exactly. I would say salads make up probably about a third of our menu. The rest is things like the fish finger wrap with fresh tartar sauce. It's our sort of equivalent of the fillet of fish. Things like the chicken burger with sort of olive oil, tarragon, mayonnaise. Things like the Moroccan meatballs with organic basmati rice and slaw. So a lot of the menu has a lot of plants in it. But then we have things like the original superfood salad. And I think before we actually named the superfood salad, as strange as it sounds, there was no such thing as a superfood salad before we did it. Now there are obviously lots of examples of it. But the last sort of third of the dish, where you've got the seeds and you've got the quinoa and the feta and the olive oil and the herbs all mixed in, you've actually got these absolute lovely pieces of deliciousness at the bottom of the box. And I think that the range of textures and flavors is unique to salads, as you say.
So what is it about the architecture of a salad?
I think the thing to recognize is that if you can apply different cooking techniques and potentially work out whether you're trying to do a sort of raised salad. So for example, the chicken and rice noodle salad, that wants to be in a bowl. But if I think about one of the other dishes that I absolutely love, if I look at the Belgian steak salad, for example, on page 80, working out what order you're going to do things in is really important. So, for example, is this a dish where the meat that you've cooked is going to be discovered underneath the leaves? Or in the case of the Belgian steak, do you want to look at it with your eyes and see the steak in its full glory? So I think one of the big things about architecture is not just how does it physically look in terms of the structure, but which bits of the salad are presented first. And I would say you've got a choice generally. Are you going to sort of create a salad where the components are relatively separate, like in the Belgian steak salad, or are you going to mix everything in so much, like the Vietnamese noodle salad, because everything needs to be tasted at once together, because it's all of those flavours in every forkful or in every spoonful that needs to be present. So I think if one's creating one salad from scratch, that's a key question. Is this a salad of components where things should be enjoyed in layers? Or is this something in which every spoonful should have a tiny piece of every single flavor?
If you had to boil it all down or toss it all up, maybe, what are your five desert island salads?
I mentioned two of them. The original superfood salad has been on our menu since 2004 when we started with the broccoli, the peas, the cucumber, the feta, the toasted seeds, avocado, the flat-leaf parsley, the fresh mint and the vinaigrette. Those flavours for me are my go-to if I've got a hangover or I just need to make sure that I'm feeling good the rest of the day. So I think that would be one. There's a classic Asian salad called Som Tam, which has Thai red chilies, dried shrimps, and that reminds me very much of being on the beach or in Bangkok. The one that we've launched just now is actually my current favourite, which I've mentioned, which is the Vietnamese, or the, as we call it, the chicken and rice noodle salad, again, with a little bit of fish sauce. And then for, I'm just trying to find it in here, I think we call it Get Figgy With It, but there's a lovely fig dish that we do, which is fantastic when figs are in season.
Switching subjects completely, you co-wrote England's school food plan. Can you tell us about it and the transformations that have resulted from its publication?
Yes, in 2012, we were asked to write a report. And we said, you know what, thanks very much. We're not going to write a report, but we will write a plan. We will actually write something which where the actions are agreed prior to publication. So the government said, okay, fair enough. And our role was really to define what food should be in schools and to sort of make it much less segregated than it is between the caterers and the teachers and the cooks. And what we ended up with was, number one, free school meals for everyone in the first 3 years of being at school, in what we called infants, ages 5, 6, and 7. The second was practical cooking on the curriculum, which hadn't been done before. So practical cooking of savoury dishes, not just, oh, look, mum, I've made a cake. Thirdly, we had new legislation around what could and couldn't be served to children. And fourth, there was lots of free breakfast for disadvantaged children.
Give me examples of what you said must not be fed to children.
Clearly, we make sure that all of the food in the food regulations is free from what you might call additives, preservatives, or colourings. We know that from the science that was around in 2012 and from the emerging science that those things play with the hormonal balance in the body and they play with the gut microbes in the body, especially of children. And so we first of all eliminate those. Secondly, we try and cut down on sugar and sugary carbohydrates. So we recognize the metabolic impact of sugars and again the impact that they have on the digestive system as well. So, you know, we're very much looking to cut down on sugars. Then we look to actively promote things which are going to be actively good for the children. So the major challenge with children, as you know, is to how to make vegetables taste good. And that's the challenge we all have as grown-ups as well. How do you make, you know, if you haven't been used to them, how do you make vegetables taste good? So there's a huge amount of innovation around flavouring meat. So, you know, not just sort of roast dinners, if you like, where there's a good representation of broccoli or carrots or things like that, but also how do we use herbs and spices that are acceptable to children. So maybe a mild chicken and vegetable curry, for example. You know, how do we make vegetables taste good? So there's a lot of active proponents of a wide variety of vegetables.
John Vincent's new cookbook, he wrote it with Jane Baxter, is called Happy Salads. Next up, we look at labels on chocolate bars. That's when the show continues. Don't turn the dial.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. When you hear good chocolate, what does that mean to you? A bar with a high percentage of cocoa? Or maybe it's a bar that's milky and smooth. Maybe your mind goes to the way the cocoa was harvested, or the way the chocolate was made. Or you've just got a penchant for white, dark, or milk chocolate. Journalist Simran Sethi just created a new podcast called The Slow Melt, which is dedicated to all things cacao, cocoa, and chocolate. So what's the difference between cacao and cocoa?
They can be used interchangeably, but typically what is referred to as cacao is the fruit. We eat the seeds of a fruit that looks like a football or a honeydew melon. It could be ridged or smooth, that's colorful. I mean, it could be green, purple, orange. And they look like they're stuck onto a tree, like what I describe in my book as a botanical game of pin the tail on the donkey. I mean, it's so improbable. I had never realized a substance that I've been eating my entire life came from a fruit that I wouldn't recognize in nature. Nor did I understand that what we actually eat are what start off as bitter seeds. They're surrounded by a white pulp. The pulp can be lemony, it can be sweet and peanutty, it can be so many different flavors. And from there, that seed, once processed and roasted, can also have a wide range of flavors that we may not have experienced if all we stuck to is our like traditional Hershey's bar or Snickers bar. But there's a whole world that's opening up with the expansion of craft chocolate that I really think people will love once they get a chance to explore it.
So let's spend a moment on the diversity of cacao. There were reclassifications in the last decade. How does recognizing the diversity of all the varieties help preserve the fruit?
It's perhaps one of the more important ways we do this. Back in 2008, in a study that was led by a gentleman named Juan Carlos Motamayor, he is a plant geneticist, and he worked with a team of researchers to reclassify what had been these kind of three very vague categories of cacao. It was criollo, which in Spanish means native, forastero, which is stranger, and trinitario, which was native of Trinidad. But that didn't encompass the wide range of cacao that we were experiencing. Cacao grows in a thin belt around the equator, but you can find it in Vietnam, you can find it in Trinidad, in Venezuela, in Hawaii, in all these places. Through this genetic mapping and this extraction of DNA from the leaves, Motomayor and his team expanded these categories to 10 clusters, and they were based on geographical location or on the traditional variety that was kind of most representative of the cluster. And what that's done is help people to understand that there is diversity in this crop. And since then, since 2008, we've already seen it expand again to like 14 classifications. By understanding diversity exists in this crop, we recognize that diversity is something that we should actually save. And the reason that's important is because, you know, we've bred all of our foods, not just chocolate, largely for yield and for disease resistance. And it's become a kind of genetic bottleneck where we're growing and consuming fewer varieties. And if we haven't explored or preserved or savored the backup versions of these, the diverse versions of these, then we're in real danger of losing them.
And will this increase awareness of biodiversity in cacao also help deal with the changes that are coming are, in fact, are already here from climate change?
Definitely, this is one way to create a hedge against climate change. This, again, isn't exclusive to cocoa. What we see is if we're just growing a few varieties, right, and we kind of have these models of what will happen to cocoa, coffee, et cetera, in the future, and we see that, oh, my gosh, the varieties that we're growing are not drought tolerant. They're not heat resistant. What are we going to do? Well, if we've preserved this diversity, we can breed in some of those qualities, and that becomes the hedge against climate change. That enables us to have a backup system so we have other choices. You know, climate modeling is an extraordinary thing, but it's also incredibly imprecise. So you'll see these wild kind of vacillations of you know, how much cacao might be lost, how much coffee or other foods might be lost. And so that's the reason that it's so important to really preserve a broad range of these things. But it's also recognizing that disease is something that wipes out about one-third of the crop that is currently grown. So farmers really need to be able to tap again into diverse kinds of traits when a crop becomes unviable. And for me, so the diversity is also about this other component, which is a lot of it happens to be extraordinarily delicious tasting. And by recognizing we don't just have terroir in something like wine, but we also have it in something like chocolate. I mean, it's just like, I mean, it's opening up a whole new world for our palates.
When we're buying a bar of chocolate at the grocery store, there are so many words on the labels, from organic. We see fair trade, we see Rainforest Alliance. What do they all mean, and what do we really need to know?
There's a lot to know. What I'll say about these three things is that none of these three certifications you just mentioned have anything to do with flavor. And I think that's critical, because what I'm looking for, certainly in a bar, is something that was made well, in which farmers were treated well, but also something that's delicious. Fair trade certification is an economic mechanism to ensure that farmer cooperatives are paid a fair price. It doesn't mean an individual farmer is getting paid a price premium, and it doesn't mean that that chocolate is one that might have a particularly interesting flavor profile. It is a wonderful starting point for exploring what it means to pay a farmer fairly for his or her wage. But the new model that's emerging is one that's parallel to coffee, which is direct trade. And that is one where chocolate makers are trying to really cut out a lot of the middle people and move toward working directly with farmers. And those relationships are ones that are still growing. There's not a certification protocol in place for that, but that's something that I really consider when I'm looking for a fine chocolate. When it comes to organic, what we're looking at is a product that was grown without synthetic pesticides or insecticides. That doesn't mean that there aren't natural ways to support these crops and you know, afford insect protection or disease protection. But what this also does is puts a stranglehold on farmers in the sense of they're not able to use any of these synthetic products. So if they are felled, if the crop is compromised by a disease that is quite resistant to some of these natural inputs, and these farmers can't use the synthetic ones, then they're really put in a bind. So it's something that I definitely strive for, but it's not something that I necessarily hold hard and fast because I understand how much disease can ravage this crop. When it comes to rainforest certification, what we're looking at is a certification protocol that's looking at how the cacao is grown and what areas are protected. Again, it's not a comprehensive system, but it's a great start in really trying to advance a more ecologically friendly way of cultivating cacao. And what I really love about the emerging craft chocolate movement is that it's one that is really considering a lot of these parameters, but not holding fast to any one of them, really allowing farmers to have some flexibility, recognizing that these certification protocols are timely, are expensive, and that some of these smaller farmers may not be able to spend that money or time reaching those certifications, but really working toward creating relationships, enduring relationships with these people, and then translating those relationships to consumers. So we start to get a sense of chocolate as an agricultural product, as the seed of a fruit, and as something that has seasonality, has a different harvest, and has a quality that will evolve and be as dynamic as something like a bottle of wine.
When you're looking for a piece of chocolate, what do you reach for? And you're allowed to mention names here, but so we don't like decimate one brand, maybe you can name a few.
Let me back up really quickly and say flavor extraordinarily starts right with the bean. It starts where the bean has been grown. There was wonderful research done by a researcher in Trinidad at the University of West Indies named Darren Suka. And he talked about how in his work, he discovered that a lot of the floral qualities we find in chocolate are the product of genetics, whereas the fruity qualities are more a reflection of the soil and the place where the cacao was processed and fermented. So it starts right there if we allow for it. When you buy an industrial bar of chocolate, you know, a Hershey's, a Snickers, a Twix, what have you, we're looking for sameness. When we start to explore this diversity, I mean, it blew my mind. I'm not going to lie, Evan. When I'm sitting there in the forest for my first time in Ecuador and I'm tasting, first of all, the fruit off the you know, inside the pod, and then I'm tasting these roasted seeds because they're quite bitter until they're roasted and processed, I had no idea what diversity existed here. Then it gets into the hands of the maker, where they are adding to this quality by roasting. I mean, through roasting, we have the experience of what's called the Maillard reaction. The Maillard reaction is a chemical reaction that helps caramelize a lot of the flavors that are present. And then all the things that they might include as part of their recipe, inclusions, the amount of cocoa butter they use, the way they temper their chocolate, all of this stuff factors into the end product. Bean to bar is an extraordinary notion. But what I want to remind people of is it's kind of a mislabel because, you know, what we're trying to say is like that a chocolate maker has overseen this process from the start, from the bean all the way to the bar. But that's exactly what these big companies have done too. I think what a craft chocolate maker brings to this is a smaller scale and a greater focus and more attention. Some of my favorite bars are a chocolate maker in Canada called Soma is one of my favorites. There's a chocolate maker in Hawaii, Madre Chocolate. They actually grow the chocolate as well as making it. They grow the cacao. That's another favorite of mine. There's a tiny maker, Eric Parks, up in Somerville, Massachusetts, Somerville Chocolate. He makes a blend with hops, which it just like blows my mind. Patrick, outside of St. Louis. There's Rogue Chocolatier, you know, consistently winning award after award. There's Fruition in upstate New York. Brian Graham just won Best International Milk Chocolate made with beans that were coming from Peru.
Okay,
there's
wait.
Such a range.
I have to stop you. Best milk chocolate.
Yeah.
Because I am a milk chocolate person, and I get so much guff, let's say, from my snobby friends who just are saying to me, you don't know anything. I'm so disappointed in you if it's not bitter. But I just love milk chocolate.
Evan, I'm right there with you, Mama. I mean, I love milk chocolate. There is a bar from Soma. It's called like Old School Milk, made with this wonderful cacao from Venezuela, and it is absolutely exquisite. This move toward purity was one where it's like, let's just have two ingredients. Let's have the cocoa bean and some sugar. You know, a cocoa bean is about 50% fat, so you've got all that cocoa butter there. But some makers include more cocoa butter to give it a richer quality, like a richer mouthfeel. But there's this movement toward expanding that out. You know, the same people who used to poo-poo white chocolate, right, because there's no actual cocoa nib in there. It's just the cocoa butter, the fat, are also some of the same people who are now creating white chocolate bars. So I think we're seeing an evolution where we're going from that purist stance to one that's like, yeah, you know what? We like milk solids. We actually like milk chocolate. What has happened, though, is a lot of the kind of craftier milks are what are called dark milk chocolates. So they have a little bit less sugar in them. For a bar in the United States to be called a chocolate bar, it has to have 10% cocoa solids. But typically what you'll see in a craft chocolate bar are percentages like 70%, 80% and upwards. So it's really about looking at kind of that balance. But with a dark milk bar, you might see something closer to 50%. And, you know, I have to say, like, out of all the bars I've tried and I've also gone from both extremes, I would settle on dark milk any day of the week.
Wow. What is the best way to eat chocolate besides cramming it into our mouth as fast as possible?
That is actually not the best way, according to science. There's a chemist named Peter Schieberle, and he identified there are about 600 flavor compounds present in chocolate. It makes it one of the most flavorful foods that we experience, that we consume. And a lot of that, you know, is locked up in the fat, right? So the thing I love about it, the reason I call my podcast a slow melt, is because this is about the relationship. When we pop that chocolate in our mouth, sure, you can chomp it and swallow it, but you're missing out on this experience of the release of these flavor compounds. These are predominantly aroma compounds, right? Most of what we experience as flavor is smell. They unleash when they start to melt in the mouth, and it is an extraordinary experience. And what this researcher, Peter Schieberle, says is if you chew it, you know, and swallow it, you're missing out on all of that. This chemical reaction in which all of these flavor compounds are released happens then if we let it melt on our tongue. So what I suggest people do is actually try both. Like, give it a slow melt and then chew it quickly. And what you'll find is they're two different expressions. Like, you'll actually have different flavors come at you. This takes a little bit of practice. And again, this is not a hard thing. We're talking about practicing with chocolate. But at first, you know, it's like chocolate's just chocolate. Like, at least for me, I knew it as one thing. I didn't taste all these fruity flavors or floral flavors. And now they've revealed themselves to me. You know, I think it's like for anybody who, the first time they have a cup of coffee or a glass of wine, like, it's just whatever punches you in the face. And then the subtleties emerge once you stick with it and pay attention. And so I would suggest to people, as you get ready to make your chocolate forays into the world, look at where it comes from. See if it has an origin listed. If it does, that means that the person who made that bar, the company that made that bar, cared enough to tell you it actually came from a place. That's a really good place to start. One of my favorite origins is Vietnam. There's a wonderful maker called Maru, and they do several bars from Vietnam. My favorite is one that has like these notes of like spice and cinnamon. And again, I had to keep checking the wrapper to make sure there wasn't anything else in there. It came from the bean. It came from the place. So notice where it comes from. And then also look at that percentage. If you're someone who's been eating, like, you know, if you were like me eating Twix and Hershey's, then maybe you want to start with not 90% cocoa content. You know, that's going to seem quite bitter because there's so little sugar in there. Start with a 50, start with a 60, work your way up to a 75, see how it goes, and expand your palate that way. And then I would also say, like, explore where it was made. You know, it's so interesting to me that before I started this journey 5 years ago, I really considered chocolate being made from places like Belgium, you know, or Switzerland. It's like they come from this deeper place. And now there are makers all over the world doing extraordinary things. I want to support these small makers, and I want to see what kind of magic they're creating, and I want to see what happens when I get in contact with that product. So I would say, you know, it's a low-stakes way to really explore and savor the world. It's cheaper than a bottle of wine. It's a great taste experience, and I would just line up a couple of different makers from one origin, or take one maker and look at a couple of different origins that they offer and start to see what it is that you love.
That's journalist and author Simran Sethi. Find a link to the blog post she wrote about chocolate for the Smithsonian on our website.
My name is Maksymilian Dąbkowski. I'm from Poland. I'm a sophomore student at Brown University this year, and I study linguistics and computer science and or philosophy, you know, any subset of the three.
What are you submitting a proposal for?
I'm submitting a proposal for the pretzel emoji, one of the most timeless and recognizable baked foods on Earth that is somehow sadly lacking in the emoji set yet. Mm-hmm.
That tape comes to us from our supervising producer, Abby Fentress-Swanson. She talked to Maximilian at EmojiCon, a conference in San Francisco last week devoted in its entirety to emoji. That's the language of 1,800 characters on our cell phones and computers that most of us use every day, from winky faces to gringo tacos.
What are the meanings that you might be able to convey by using that emoji?
Twisted, not confusion. We even have the idiom of pretzel logic, for example. The twist in the pretzel can stand for the plot twist, for example. But also it can be used for many other situations which involve some degree of, like, uneasiness or confusion if we're to allow for the pretzel emoji to stand on its own and represent that kind of structure that the pretzel has.
Wow. A linguistic nerd for sure.
Totally. And, you know, maybe this week after, you know, the election, I might want to use a pretzel emoji if it happened to be approved. I don't know.
It's interesting, actually, how emoji do have way more than one meaning.
They do, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that the Unicode Consortium looks at, is that if a food has a double meaning, there's a stronger case for accepting it, so to say.
What other food emoji applications are being considered? And how does the Unicode Consortium decide what will be included and what won't be included?
Some of the foods where there are applications, which I've been told are strong applications, are the bowl of cereal, which we'll hear about in a second, broccoli, the sandwich, which you and I are both big fans of. I would be supportive of that. The applicants must sort of, in a big proposal, and I read a lot of them, they have to justify a reason why their emoji should be introduced, why it would be popular and distinctive. So you might say, how popular is your food, say broccoli, compared to a hamburger? How popular is your fruit compared to an apple?
Is there a seasonal flow to how this happens? Is there a proposal accepting period?
Yes, there is. So every October, about 70 proposals, or at least in the past several years, about 70 proposals have been filed. And then depending on the strength of the proposal, it has been the case that about half of them have been assigned to a committee. And these proposals are then sort of fleshed out in a committee. And the ones that make it through, there's a beta version of these emojis are created. And then by the time June and July roll around, the Unicode standard, as it's called, gets implemented. Then all of the various companies that use emoji, like Apple and all these other tech companies that use them, they all make their own sort of versions. That's why you might see down the line, hopefully, a sandwich emoji, and it'll look a little different. But that's
the
cycle.
Or a pie emoji.
Actually, there is a pie emoji that has been submitted.
And who is the Unicode Consortium? How many people is it?
It's a lot of tech folks. I don't know exactly the number, but Apple, Google, Facebook, so the heavy hitters.
So I understand that you talked to Ricky De La Vega, a web designer who lives here in L.A., about his application for a cereal emoji. So let's hear that tape.
If you look at what cereal is, it's fascinating. Everyone eats some variety of this something in a bowl every morning, that some sort of grain with some sort of liquid or not, congee, porridge, oatmeal, granola. It just goes on and on. Like, for me, I think emoji will always have multiple meaning, and they're like a song or a painting, not something you can look up in the dictionary and get a precise definition for.
Listening to this, listening to the pretzel and then listening to the cereal, are these emojis uniquely Western? Is there a different set of emojis in other parts of the world?
Well, no, and that's a good question, because some of the new emoji coming are related to Asia. So chopsticks, fortune cookie, dumpling, which is one of my favorites. Of course, they won't be coming until next year to our keyboards, but they have been green-lighted.
It's funny the fortune cookie isn't actually Asian, but I love that.
I know. I mean, the application for these came from Jennifer Ately.
She wrote the book, The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, and she produced that documentary, The Search for General Tso.
Yeah. So it's a subject sort of near and dear to her heart, and she was one of the organizers of EmojiCon, the conference that I went to last weekend.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a fascinating thing. I just sent her an email this morning and actually said to her that in light of our most recent political news, I think we really need a hug emoji.
I think that is exactly what I need right now. Agreed.
Emoji became big news last month when the Museum of Modern Art acquired the first original set of 176 emoji for its permanent collection, which, when you think about it, is pretty interesting and astounding. The set was created in 1999 by the Japanese mobile phone company NTT Docomo. You asked the museum's Paul Galloway, what moved MoMA to make the acquisition?
Well, it fits into a kind of larger goal of addressing design in the 21st century. And if we're going to do that, we really have to focus on the tools of designers, how they're expressing themselves, what are they giving to the public right now. So that's included everything from video games to websites, interactive software-based works. We acquired Bjork's Biophilia, the first app in our collection. And emoji really fit into this very, very strongly because they definitely are something that is radically altering human behavior. We're watching it happen at a breakneck pace. And at the same time, they're also beautiful aesthetic objects. And we want people to kind of take a moment to kind of think about where they come from, how they influence our lives, and really kind of train the focus back to 1999 when Docomo is trying this new thing and the creator Shigetaka Kurita comes up with these really great designs. And we want to kind of refocus the story on him and Docomo so that when you're using emoji, you think about their Japanese origin, you think about Shigetaka Kurita.
It's also wonderful that the first set of emoji were so food-focused.
They were. It's surprising. Like, there are the drinks. There's a beer and a martini. And then there's a burger. And, you know, it looks very old school. It's like almost like the Miss Pac-Man style because it's from 1999. And then there's a fork and knife. I think the idea was to tell people where food was originally when you're using them, you know, to use the emoji like an actual language, not just like to send your love a little heart or a kiss or whatever. It also made me think of, I'm really excited about the new emoji that are coming out. And these are ones that were approved this June. And one of them is a whiskey glass. And you know how much I like whiskey. You're also going to be able to see the avocado, kiwi, potato, carrot, cucumber, peanuts, bacon, another near and dear one to my heart. So, you know, this is constantly evolving, and it's a really kind of fun and interesting intersection of food, art, and technology.
That's our supervising producer, Abby Frances Swanson. Check out pictures of the food emoji we've been talking about on our blog, and let us know your favorites on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Just search for us by our handle, KCRW Good Food. Next, we get a food recommendation from Jonathan Gold. I wonder if it has an emoji. Stay with us.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Have you heard of that technique of, like, you take tangerine things and you, like, sort of, like, dry them for maximum crunch?
To me, that technique is you take a tangerine, you peel it, and you forget to eat it. And then it gets really crisp. I've never heard of, like, as an actual technique, but it does make sense.
I don't know if he did that, but it sort of had that effect.
That's our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold. Jonathan, where are you taking us this week?
We're going to Silver Lake.
And what is new there?
We're going to Kettle Black, which, despite its name, is a new Italian restaurant.
I don't get the name.
I don't either.
Does it mean something that I don't understand? As in calling the kettle black?
Probably. It's the sister restaurant to Sawyer, a couple doors away. You know, separated only by Clover Juice Bar, which is owned by the same people.
Who's the chef?
The chef is Sidney Hunter, who we've talked about it a bunch before on the show. I think he's probably best known as the former chef of Petit Trois. He worked for, you know, Ludo Lefebvre for a really long time, starting in the L'Orangerie days.
What kind of Italian food is this?
I don't know. It's not regional Italian food. It's not rustic Italian food. It's sort of idiosyncratic, I guess. But, I mean, he has a style, right? I mean, he likes a bit of chili. He likes sweet, sour flavors. He's big on crunch. You'll find breadcrumbs. And, you know, again, with the chilies, as much for the fragrance of them as for the heat.
Is this a dining out a couple times a month during the week kind of place, or is this a waiting for the weekend? And
I have found it best as a Tuesday night restaurant. And I think the way that a lot of people tend to use it is they come to the bar. It's mostly bar with food. And they're drinking, and the plates going by look really good. And I was thinking of you, actually, when I ordered the panzanella. I know what a big panzanella fan you are.
You're so funny. Just because I made something for 30 years doesn't mean I'm such a fan.
But their version is so different from not just yours, but any I've ever had. It becomes like an arugula salad with like triple croutons.
Oh, I like that version kind of. Is this a small plates restaurant or is this a place where you go have antipasti and pasta or an entree?
From the menu, it looks as if it was set up to be traditional. But the wait staff comes and gives you this is a small plates restaurant. We've designed everything for sharing speech, so it's the latter.
Okay, so take me through some of the dishes that you ordered.
Some of the things I like were like a crudo or slices of raw sea bream, those crushed pink peppercorns, and little sort of crisp tangerine segments on each one. My favorite dish there is the eggplant. It's like Japanese eggplant. They cut it into fat slices. They pass it through the fire to roast it, but just pick up a little bit of smokiness, drizzle it with a little bit of oil and a few drops of saba, which is, you know, basically boiled wine. And it's nice. It's sweet. There's a crunchiness. There's that bit of tartness from the saba. There's the sprinkle of salt. It's a really nice vegetable.
What about the pasta?
They're really good at pasta. I mean, they're so much better at pasta than you'd think they would be. It's not that sort of like chunky, fudgy, not quite cooked texture that we're seeing all over town. I mean, it's a really nice, supple, you know, fresh pasta. There's like a garganelli with bolognese sauce and pappardelle with a sauce of sautéed maitake mushrooms. Not just maitake mushrooms. There's also nasturtium butter.
Of course.
Does everything have nasturtiums on it
now? Well, nasturtiums are pretty and they're also peppery. So kind of if you're going to go that way, it's actually a good one.
Yeah, it is. I was trying to theorize whether we were at peak nasturtium at the moment.
And I would say to you that peak nasturtium was in the 90s.
Could have been. Though I must say in Copenhagen, really? I don't think I went to a single restaurant that didn't have nasturtiums on them.
Anyway.
So many nasturtiums. A lot of people will go there for the pizza. It's not like a specialist pizza, but it's nice. It's crisp. It's risen. It has those black spots that you always see in a place with a new wood oven.
Sounds like a good neighborhood restaurant.
Yeah, you'd be happy if it were in your neighborhood, I think. Well, not you, because you never go out for Italian food, but
no, I would now.
Other people.
I would now if there were a nice Italian restaurant in my neighborhood. Given that you can't ever get into John and Vinny's.
You can't ever get into John and Vinny's. You know, now, if Leo's Tacos decided to sell, like, you know, wood-fired pizzas alongside their al pastor, that would be your perfect restaurant, I think.
You're very funny. What about the word that doesn't mean anything anymore, entrees?
I was about to, like, say something dismissive about it, but the Bronzino is actually really nice. It's a filet. There's a lemon caper sauce. And it comes sort of like layered over something that I think might have bothered me as a kid. Rice potatoes with escarole. And if you're somebody who has phobias about food touching, this is going to set off every alarm that you ever had. I mean, it's almost a side dish that should come with a trigger warning. I mean, I'm so not that person anymore, but there's something about this that like almost brings out your inner OCD.
It sounds good though.
Yeah.
Potatoes with escarole. That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Kettle Black in Silver Lake. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Well, that's it for this week's show. You can listen to any of the segments at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. Here they are.
Abby Fentress-Swanson.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.